Hi, this is David Clone, CEO and founder of the Holonai Network and director of their Behavioral Sciences Unit, and you're listening to the Holonai Network's Mindhunter podcast on Radio Haver.
Haver. It's not easy butchering people. It's hard work. You know, there's a lot more like me.
We're talking to serial killers.
Serial killers!
New terminology.
Are criminals born, or are they formed?
How do we get ahead of crazy if we don't know how crazy thinks?
It's easier to ask for forgiveness than for permission.
Welcome to the Holonai Mindhunter Podcast.
This will be case file number 003 in the ongoing Holonai Network Behavioral Sciences investigation of the Netflix original series Mindhunter. Dave the Clone beginning the proceedings here, directing the team. Joining me on the panel tonight from last time and again from next time, just as a heads up, T.W. Brown, author of the Dead series. Joining us again also, Mr. C.J. Ripka, special agent and better half of the Grit and Grace TV streaming show and Saloon 7 Productions. And taking the spot for our esteemed colleague Jenny, who could not make it, we have someone all the way over from, what was the name of the station that your show is on, Mr. Zane?
Oh, it's Red Hawk Radio.
All the way over from Red Hawk Radio, bringing us a new perspective from both a pre-medical and psychological perspective, Mr. Zane Sexton.
Howdy.
And we are here to continue talking, riding right on into episode 3, probably after the introduction of Ed Kemper, the big Ed Kemper episode that I think some of the best one-liners come from, right? Some of the best series memory seared into our memories lines that make this show as awesome as it is. But a lot happens. We've got Anna Torv kind of becoming part of the fold. When we got to this episode, what were your guys' thoughts? Anybody? Actually, Zane, why don't you tell us, since you're the new one here, have you seen all of Mindhunter? What was your first impression of the show overall? What do you remember from this zone of episode 3?
Oh, I thought episode 3 was the beginning of the story elements, because kind of before that was mostly just lost setup. But now the real juicy, action-y stuff happens. I thought it was a really enjoyable episode because Dr. Wendy Carr, one of my favorite characters on the show, finally graces the audience with her presence, so that's good. And yeah, I've always thought that's really interesting because the characters get their first real taste of success. It's kind of like, hey, what we're doing is working, and we should be able to keep doing this, and we should be able to make money. And, you know, I think Holden has this desire and kind of grandiosity idea that he's going to write a book. It's like a lot of subtle details that really like make a lot of the characters more three-dimensional. So yeah, and Mindhunter, I've always liked Mindhunter ever since it came out when I was a young lad. when I was a young fool of 19. And yeah, I've always liked it. David Fincher is a mastermind and genius, of course. And all the other writers and actors themselves are extremely talented. I've always thought that Holden was a bit of a weirdo, but hey, that's just me, because he reminds me too much of myself. So, hey. Coincidence? I think not.
Well, we have the perfect guest filling in with us tonight, so that's definitely reassuring. T.W., what'd you think of episode 3? You have a general sort of response or sort of first reaction before we start getting into some of the details?
For me, this is the one where they really start moving in a direction and, you know, they get their first taste of, you know, quote, success early on, or at least perceived success early on. And I was glad to see them go back into the prison to start the interview process again and really sort of dial in what they were doing now that they had focus. And you could tell that they were starting to gel And that for me is when, you know, you could see that since this is the genesis of something that, you know, becomes real, you can see how an idea sort of starts one direction, coagulates, and then splits, and then comes back together to form something else until it finally gets rid of all the garbage and really goes in a solid sort of concrete, you know, driving. I don't want to really say direction because I've already used it over and over again, but it really finds a place, you know, and it finds its course.
There you go.
And it's nice to watch that start to happen. And having Carr come in for that, I think, is a saving grace.
And CJ, what about you? Any kind of opening thoughts here?
I guess it's definitely a starting point. Is you're starting to see where this is what the FBI is about. It's not just going out on the road teaching classes. It's there's actually things that's going on, and they're able to utilize the things that they're learning to be able to solve crime. To me it seems like it's a little bit overexcitement on Holden's part. A little mm-hmm. bit is like he wants to show how smart he is. He wants to show how great he is out right away. And this was kind of one of those episodes where it just kind of worked out, and it really kind of showed the potential of the series is going to go. Not only that, it really starts by introducing Dr. Webb. It really kind of starts looking like, okay, we're building a team, and it, mm-hmm. it's to start taking off in a direction. We got the figure that's going to keep us focused. Now we got the soldiers down out in the trenches. We're going to make it happen.
Especially for anyone who's familiar with Anna Torv's previous project of prominence, and I don't do alliteration on purpose like that. It just sort of rolls off the tongue. But anyone who is a fan of Fringe, you know, that was a Three Amigos situation. We had the trio of the mad scientist, the sort of reluctant hero, and she was the young apprentice. And in this one, we have the young apprentice kind of being also the mad scientist, because Holden is in this, you know, gung-ho, all in from minute one. For him, it's all this kind of like his ego is almost on par with the egos of the guys that they're going to start interviewing in this episode. And I think that's one of the things, having watched the whole season, you know, we've already, we'll make the disclaimer again, like we do every case file, you know, we're speaking of this in terms that some may consider what you would call spoilery if you haven't watched the whole thing. So we encourage you to have watched at least the episode we're talking about beforehand, before listening. And if you haven't done that yet, please, by all means, pause now. We'll be here when you come back. Go watch it and then come back. But we're probably going to drop a few hints. I tend to forget some details that might come from the next episode, I might think, or in this episode. My colleagues will keep me honest, and we'll just have to deal with the fact that shit that just is going to stay in the edit, guys. Just deal with it. So watch the whole season, come back and listen. But anyway, I think one of the big archetypes is Holden's sort of almost the way Keanu worships Patrick Swayze in Point Break. Holden has the sort of hero worship perspective when they start talking to these guys. And I think Tench is there supposed to be to balance him out, and then you have Carr come in, and she's a little bit on both sides, because she's encouraging Holden to follow his instincts, but then she wants to put more structure and formality to it. So it's kind of an interesting mix we've got going on there.
I think if Holden was a religious charismatic, he would be David Koresh.
Oh, nice. I do kind of feel like that's
a mystery machine, you know, like the mystery game. You got the smart one, you got the strong-willed one, you got the dork. All we're missing is a dog. And that, oh no, Kemper is the dog, in that analogy.
So. Nice. And he does have that sort of, his voice is the uniqueness that sort of Scooby's voice would be, right? You know, like, it's
exactly,
got,
yes.
It's almost like a sing-songy quality to the way he's talking. And that's definitely part of his charisma that's drawing us in. And drawing in Tench to become a more of a believer in the project. I mean, one of my favorite exchanges in the whole show And often by the time I reach the end of the season, I kind of forget about it until I rewatch it from the beginning. The part when they're waiting to go into the prison to speak to the one prisoner who decides not to talk to them, you know, decides, oh, yeah, I don't feel like doing this today. But when they're outside and Tench is smoking and they're talking about their relationships and he's like, well, this is the first woman I've ever, like, dated. And he goes, well, my wife is the first one I've ever married. You know, it's like these kind of little idiosyncrasies that start to become the last remnants, I think, of Holden's humanity towards the end of the season. And it's kind of interesting to look at them now and how they're being discovered as they're going into this territory that's going to serve to kind of pull them together and push them apart. I'm talking about Holden and Tench, if anyone's not keeping up out there in listener land.
Well, that's good writing right there. Because everyone hates each other, and I like writing that emphasizes that. Because, you know, I hate you, you hate me. We're all a big, hateful family.
It's always good to have something gluing everything together.
Kind of a reverse party.
So, when we see Ed being interviewed by our guys in the beginning, and he's kind of getting slight rewards, right? He's getting pizza. He's starting to ask for a typewriter. And we see Holden.
I'm going to kill for pizza.
And we see, yeah, literally. And we see Holden is sort of very quick to be agreeable to these things. And then they go and speak to the next prisoner, who I can't remember what this guy's name was. And even I just watched the episode. This is what happens when you watch the episode the day of. It's like cramming for a fucking test. And then you come to the thing, and you're like, yeah, shit, that guy, what was his name? He was the one who wanted soda, and he wouldn't talk to them until they got him the soda. This is like where Holden realizes it's almost like a Pavlovian process where if you bring a treat, they'll give you some stuff you can use.
Well, that's the aspect that they show, that again, going back to sort of humanizing these guys in lockup, they're being deprived of all the things that we just see as normal everyday things. To them, that pizza's gold. I mean, if you can walk back out into the yard, or if you can go back to your cell, trust me, they'll smell it on you because it's such a foreign thing. And it's going to be like, yeah, just had a pizza, just, you know, put down some pepperoni. I mean, that's a thing that, again, like I said, that's showing them really immersed in their environment, because those are the things that are important to them. Out here, we're asking for money. Mm-hmm. In there, they're asking for things that we don't even think about, that are just everyday items. But in there is a super luxury. Pizza, soda, things like that we can just, you know.
Bars. anything that they can use as that has value to something for some reason, they're going to use that trade. Now with the pizza thing, I found it kind of interesting though with the pizza thing, because there was an air about that whole interview where it was just relaxed. We're just hanging out. We're real chummy right now. Oh, do you mind? No, go ahead, eat it. You know,
that's all they set up. You know,
yeah,
and all it's set up to the whole like, hey, if we are friends, then hey, maybe you can help each other out.
Well, you look at it like it'd be set up. You look at it like, oh, we're setting this up so we can get the information. And I get that. I understand that. But with Holden, though, there's a fine line there. And I think we start seeing him starting to bridge that line, you know, cross over that line back and forth. He knows that this guy is a cold-blooded killer. He understands that. But at the same time, he also, it's like he blurs that concept, because while they're in there, like we discussed on the last episode, you start blurring those things. You don't see them as the cold-blooded killer anymore. You start to personalize them a little bit. And I think we start seeing that in this episode, where Holden's starting to personalize Kemper a little bit. And it takes Tench to actually depersonalize that, take that personality away from him a little bit, and kind of remind them a little bit more that, hey, this is the cold-blooded killer. This is our subject, not our buddy.
Yeah, you can start to get to the point where the humanization changes into the fact that you do forget what it is, what you're sitting with. You know, I mean, but I mean, he's able to do this right after being explained, you know, the whole theory of what having your throat slit ear to ear is about.
Oh,
you
know,
and then just go right over that. And now let's have some pizza, you know. So, but there's still an aspect is if you're going to get information out of this guy, you've got to treat him at least with some sense of humanness so that the guy feels like a person and doesn't feel like he's on display or like he's being treated like a monster. Because that guy is sensitive enough, he's probably going to shut down on you.
Yeah.
And I think that's where some of the psychology that comes into play. But I think the problem for Kemper the most is the fact that he keeps forgetting where he's at.
Yeah.
You know, he does forget where he's at a lot of times and who he's dealing with.
He's too familiar, you think? Like he.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's a guy that likes to sit and talk. He'll tell every story in the book. He don't care. He just likes to talk. He likes to be the center of attention. Very, very much that guy that's pretty much. What's the word I'm looking for? The narcissist in the room type of thing where, hey, it's got to be about me. If it's not about me, then I don't have any time for it.
Yeah, but at the same time, it's coupled with this beyond cold, calculating mind. You know what I mean? The sociopathy is just as strong as the narcissism because he's able to talk about, you know, sort of separating the fact of a living person and seeing them as trophies to replace things that he has no familiarity with in his life because of the period of time he didn't get to spend out in the real world because he was convicted for murdering his grandparents. He missed the time where you learn how to talk to girls and you learn how to date. And, you know, he talks about being in the squad car. And, like, a girl walked past the squad car, a group of girls walked, and he just puked because he had, in his mind, no programming to be able to interact with the opposite sex. And so later, carrying the head of one of his victims in a duffel bag, walking into his apartment building, he walks past a couple on their way out, and it instantly triggers him thinking, oh, you know, like, the murder is him taking control of his reality, right? It's taking control of and replacing experiences he didn't have or wasn't able to have. And it's hard to keep that in mind, even I think for us as the audience, even while he's telling these stories because of the way his sort of tone is, you know, and what we're taking for sort of comforting charismatic is actually the biggest proof of him being a sociopath. It's the proof that he's able to talk about it so calmly. And it's like such a horrific thing for anyone who, you know, has the moral compass that murder is wrong.
Well, you ask anybody who's known, for example, you talk to next door neighbors of these people, these killers that have been arrested and brought. They're like, I never knew anything about that. I mean, he seemed like such a nice guy.
Yep.
And, you know, this character, it's showing that, it's proving that, like everybody does love this character. He is based on a serial killer.
Yeah. When do you ever see them interview a person at the, you know, in the neighborhood and have them say that person was a winged out whack job? You know, it just never happens.
Well, some people.
Yeah.
You know,
honestly, it's happening.
You know, it's, like, you know, the overgeneralization of serial killers and what a killer is, you know, highly debatable now. So even back then, it was on a whole other level. Like with modern killers, they really seem as sympathetic to a certain kind of extent now because we get more of the backstory and the family, and we also, you know, feel for them personally and for the victims as well. Back in the 70s, it was before the Reagan years, and that should tell you something because people did not give two shits about you if you were even suspected of doing something that's not, i.e., normal, right, such as being gay or being a lesbian or being anything other than a good old American Joe.
Yeah, and I mean, this is the tail end of you know, the post free love hippie world of the 60s, right? We're still in the kind of the first backlash of trying to get back into the 50s. You know, like their director doesn't really want to hear about all this. They're still kind of, I think in episode 3, they're still operating a little bit sort of like reluctantly according to the director's kind of, you know, mind. It's like they have to fit it in the 10 hours they're allowed to, and only when they're already on the road for classes. So that's sort of the big thing that I think the Dr. Carr character starts bringing up to them, is that, you know, there's a lot of importance to what you're doing. This is in 3, right? She talks to them in 3, yeah. And you have to find a way to get other people to see the value that I'm seeing in this. Because you're doing something that I could never figure out a way to do. We're studying these guys in a laboratory practically. You know, you're getting them to open up and talk about their real feelings, what it was like when they were murdering somebody. This is the best evidence of somebody's sort of psychology we've ever been able to get.
And that's when she really pushes for their documentation of it too, to sort of start building these case files instead of just sort of throwing everything at the wall and seeing what sticks.
Yeah. And so in that too, there's another dynamic that Kemper is the first one to really show us, is that when he does start recording it and he's noticing that the levels are low, when he goes to adjust it, Kemper notices him messing with it. He goes, "You got that, right?" You know, there's a certain level of, he was almost annoyed, like, "Did you just miss the gold I was giving you?" And yeah. So now how much stock do we put into Kemper telling the truth? And when is he telling the truth? Is he ever not telling the truth? Do you ever get a feeling that he's not being truthful with them?
I don't think intentionally. I think he's built his fiction to the point where some of the grandioseness that he ascribes to himself is a creation of his own mind, but that's now the reality he sees.
Well, I think it's his reality. He's getting the truth of his reality for sure. Yeah. But you know what they say on paper on the court documents and what his reality is, very two different perspectives. So I don't think he's trying to mislead them at all. And in fact, I don't even think he's trying to convince them that his reality is the true reality. I think he's just laying it out there for them and letting them decide.
But I do think that he's been a tiny bit overeager in some aspects, because before, like, he's probably never had real friends to converse with. And since, you know, Bill and Holden are kind of his first, like, acquaintances, then he kind of, I think that he wants to, you know, show details maybe over eagerly, and that can lead to a lot of miscommunication and kind of leaving out some details, because you want to look favorably to, you know, anyone that you might want to have a relationship with, any kind of relationship. I think he might be a bit more. Like, I'm not saying that he's, you know, lying or anything, because I think he is indeed telling the truth, but maybe with a slight twist on it. Like, instead of saying, "Oh, I killed a dog when I was 8 with my BB gun," it's more like, "The BB dog just kind of went in front of me and I shot it because I was scared." Well, you know, I mean, there might be like some slight deviances of the truth with Kemper going on.
To portray himself in a more, "I'm kind of a victim of my own nature" kind of light, is what you're saying?
I think he's going more for the Frankenstein kind of mentality of, "I was kind of born this way and I can't change who I am. So is it really my fault?"
Well, I think it's also, "My mother made me this way as well." You know,
yeah, there was a big section of that in there. Yeah.
Yeah. He puts all the heads after that, after his mother. And it was the same night that he immediately had that, thought about the couple walking by. He tells his mom, "I was never really on a date," and she said, "Oh, thank God." And then after that, he started burying the heads looking up at her window, because his mother always liked people to look up to her. Like, you know, the way he tells that joke, I mean, it's such a signature of the show in my mind, of this sort of, you know, Silence of the Lambs territory here, guys. We're going to see a dude dancing around in a skin dress later. You know, be ready for some shit.
Yeah, he definitely knows he's the most intelligent guy in the room. It's not something that needs to be said. He just knows it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's what's so fascinating about him to watch. And now, I mean, not that there was anything similar to his case, but it really is from talking to him that Holden and Tench have the ability to sort of help this other detective. I forget what town, what city it was in, but we had met him previously in episode 2, and he had a case. And he had a case where the old woman was assaulted and groped, and you know, we kind of get a glimpse into, I almost want to say, the sort of still primitive nature of local police work at that time, because he said straight up, you know, I'm going after young, you know, teenagers. There's all these neighborhoods of, you know, his words now, Latinos and blacks. We immediately thought it was them. And now when he has a second victim in this third episode, we see Holden and Tench go back and revisit the case with new details. This time the suspect actually went through with the murder and both women had dogs that the killer had slit the dogs' throats. And there's almost a level of giddiness in Holden's, you know, first reaction to all this, that, you know, this is what we predicted what would happen. You know, like, it's that this is their first proof that.
See, I told you.
Yeah, the value of their work. The other thing, too, is, though, seeing how shocked the local cop is when they start describing the demographic of who they should be looking for. You know, when it becomes instantly, all right, we're not looking for young people anymore. He's like, we're looking for an older person, and we're looking for a Caucasian person. And he's just like, what? What? Like, you almost see him doing the dog chasing the tennis ball thing with his head as they're going back and forth over the details. Like, wait, what? Huh? Wait, oh shit. You know, it really kind of makes you feel like police work has been very, very not based on a lot of thinking, maybe, up until this point. You know, that the giant leap this is in detection and police work before we get into even the details of that case.
You make it the easy bust. Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of casual racism and racial profiling even way before the 1970s. Because, you know, when they made that statement that blacks or Latinos don't generally kill the elderly because they respect them too much. I think that's the line. And yeah, right. that's kind of racist. It's a very blanket statement. And I think that the show states very clearly that, you know, small towns and even the FBI to a certain extent use a lot of blanket terms and blanket statements because, you know, black people like chicken. Like, no, I think the show kind of, like, you know, goes to a good level on saying how that was kind of the attitude towards the time, because the civil rights movement was, you know, not even really, hasn't really ended yet at this point.
But I think, you know, I think when we hear
go ahead, CJ.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Sorry, dude. Go ahead.
By saying that statement is a racist statement, it's not. It's just a matter of fact statement of the time. Them saying that blacks and Latinos generally respect their elders, that's not a lie. I mean, that's not them being racist. That's being observant. They've observed this.
But if you go so far as to, like, make it, you know, as to crossing off the list of suspects, then I think that is a bit, you know, a lot more preemptive than they should have been, obviously.
I think
stereotypes does, you know, definitely makes a appearance, definitely back in this time period, and it can definitely, you know, end badly.
I think I see I get what you're bringing up, and it's sort of like, I think when Tench says that, I took it as a very, like, it shows the sort of pragmatic way that they think about things. Like, you know, whereas that local cop immediately says, oh, yeah, well, we went straight to the black and Latino neighborhood because those are the troublemakers. They're going, like, no, statistically, people, you know, black and Latino young people respect their elders and they would never do something like this. It's sort of like, it's both sides of the coin of, like, you know, sort of discriminating and using stereotypes. But I think for Holden and Tench, it's kind of part of the process that is sort of necessary. At least maybe they're the first ones showing how, you really should kind of use data to back up an assumption like that, you know, even if it's not a politically correct one or something that you want to kind of go screaming up and down the hallway. But, you know, when you're trying to figure out who's trying to fucking rape and murder old people because their dog is barking too loud, you gotta make sure you're looking at the right possibilities, I guess.
And at this time, yeah, there's no such thing as political correctness in the 1970s.
Right.
That doesn't exist.
No.
There was also...
Or in my house now.
I think, too, some of the times we see the sort of new age thinking meeting what Holden is able to bring to the surface with the way they're doing his work, are in his conversations with Debbie, right? You know, when he's telling her about not only what they got from Kemper, but then what they got from the next guy they interviewed. And then when they finally caught the guy that this Pennsylvania case was about, and how it was all these dudes responding to their moms, that their mom was sort of the impetus and the sort of driving force behind what made them start killing. She says something that there's something almost romantic about that, or something fitting about that. And it shows how sort of the new generation, like the new way of thinking, could easily see, oh yeah, I could totally see how, you know, somebody's upbringing would drive them in this direction. Whereas the old mentality was like, you know, people live their lives behind their closed doors. No one thinks about how that's going to influence. Bad guys are just bad guys for no reason. They were just born bad guys. I think that's one of the things that's kind of really what sets this show much more in that True Detective realm, which I'm going to keep saying every episode, because I also just finished rewatching season one of True Detective as we're going on this journey here with Mindhunter. And it's like the thinking man's detective show.
This again, and we've talked about it in the first two episodes. I think what makes this really interesting and entertaining for people to watch this show, especially people that fall in the demographic of the 20 to 40 something crowd, is they may not realize how accurate this is of a portrayal of our societal mindset. And I think that that's what also makes this so riveting for people who weren't there to go, wow, this is really what we were like. And then for those of us who were there to go, wow, we've come this, you know, people say we haven't come very far, but you know, you can see that there has been some progress made. I mean, we are not so, we are expanding, you know, yeah, we are broadening our minds and everything else like that. This is a real photograph of the narrow mindset that we adhered to. You know, everything was cut and dry, black and white, straight down this line. There was no such thing as deviance. And if that was deviance, it was immediately bad and immediately something that needed to be fixed. Mm. Like, and I think this takes that. And this is where the genesis of this serial killer idea comes from, is they're taking this deviance, if that's what you want to call it, and they're trying to make a checklist and say, look, this is when this sort of things happen, this is what we're looking for. These are the people we're looking for, and you've got to start opening doors and asking questions.
Zane, I didn't want to cut you off if you had something to say. I was going to take a trip down a rabbit hole off of that one. But I think probably the best magnifying glass on that is the interrogation of Dwight and the local cop in Pennsylvania watching Holden and Tench just wear this guy down to the point where he winds up, you know, confessing. But the fact that it was when we meet his mother first, right? You know, when they even show up to the house, he's immediately calling his mom. This guy's an adult, you know, this guy's in his late 20s. And he's like, mom, the police are here, you know, and so the mom has to talk to them first. She strikes us as a very abrasive kind of housewife living her, you know, sheltered existence in this small Pennsylvania town. And not just from this show, but I realized that not far from where my grandmother lived in Pennsylvania. I've driven through places like this. You know, there very well could have been this woman sitting in one of those fucking houses that I'm driving by, who's, you know, basically living her kid's life for him. When he had a girlfriend that got pregnant, the mom decided they were too young to have a kid and basically forced them to break up and have an abortion. You know, that's kind of, it's interesting to think that this is not one of the people who's winding up in prison. You know, somebody who thinks that way. She's the mom, right? This is her offspring. This is the result of her upbringings and her sort of being a parent. And it is a kid who murders old women who are a stand-in for her because their dog barks loud enough to get his attention. You know, there's something crazy about where, which one of them is the crazier one? You know, which one of them is the real criminal here? It's an interesting spotlight we start to see on stuff like this because of, and this is the newness. You know, that cop watching this whole conversation unfold, he later on says, this is Sherlock Holmes, guys. This is it. This is the future of police work right here. And that's Dr. Watson. We're still kind of like on his level. We're nowhere near this crazy fucks yet.
Yeah. They really celebrate it back at the police house.
I mean, look, people are a lot more emotional than analytical. When you strip away laws and society in general, I mean, it's proven that people don't really think all that much about the consequences when they're put into a very emotional kind of situation. Because a emotional situation calls for a more emotional response. And that's why sometimes, you know, we get stuff like this. Because feelings are hard. I mean, emotions are terrible. They leave pain and suffering. And in order to kind of decrease the suffering and the pain, they need to feel like they're in control of their own destiny. And thus, they do stuff like kill stand-ins for the mother so they can feel like they have some kind of control over their lives, because a lot of people don't, and that's just a horrible fact of life. But it's our response to that kind of pushes the line of whether we are sane or insane.
And it's interesting because they have to sympathize just enough with the mind behind these killers. You know, like Holden is playing the good cop in this interrogation, you know. Actually, they're kind of both good copping him because, you know, the details that are coming out, the mom moves a boyfriend into the house, so her bedroom is right next to the son's bedroom. He basically hears them fucking all the time. They bring that up as if, like, the way one of us would bring it up to each other, like, man, what's going on at home? I'm like, dude, I swear to God, I have to hear my mom fucking this stranger all the time. You know, and it's like, I don't expect that conversation with any of you guys to lead me to, all right, now there's a news story about me getting arrested because I've been murdering old women because I hate my mom. You know what I mean? And it's just, I think, I don't know if it's because we've watched the whole season that I feel like maybe next season we're going to see Holden start killing people. Like, Holden is on the verge of being a Dexter. But do you feel like the way we see him, even in these first three episodes, are we wrong as the audience for maybe starting to think that already, that he is just a little too good at getting familiar and sympathetic with these killers?
I really thought that was the direction that this series was going to go, and that was what I was waiting for by the final episode. I was waiting for the episode to be, if this is going to be a running series, I was waiting for the final episode to end with him taking somebody out.
Right.
You know, with the killing happening and then the camera sort of pans back as the credits roll and you see it's him. And you're like, oh, son of a bitch. I knew it.
I can't. I got to come back for season two now.
I didn't see that coming at all. But a lot of that probably has to do with the fact that I knew early on that this was based on real life characters.
Right.
You do get the feeling that maybe he's maybe a little bit of a super fan. It's almost as though it's he almost admires the way these people have conducted themselves and being able to pull off the things that they've done. But at the same time, he wants to understand everything about them because he wants to be in that mind. He wants to live in that space so he can be the super serial killer catcher or something. It's
all about the fame.
But they, you know, to catch a killer, you have to be a killer sometimes. And that's kind of where, that's kind of where I seen it going.
To catch a maniac, you send a maniac. I love that we're going Demolition Man on this.
Like, God.
I didn't find out until after we watched it because we binged this. And so when I found out afterwards that it was based on reality, that's when I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah,
I guess I'm not gonna get any luck in season two with seeing him turn into a crazed killer either. Damn it. Yeah. So, but yeah, because I mean, after I watched it, I started to look some stuff up, and I was like, "Oh crap, okay." And then, of course, the internet is a waterfall of just whatever. So you start typing it in, and you get all kinds of crap you didn't even want. So
yeah. Just as a correction, that was the Sacramento case, not the not Pennsylvania. So for everybody who was getting ready to email us about how we don't know what we're talking about, we went ahead and corrected it before we even ended the episode. So that's a big thanks to CJ for throwing that one up there on the private chat we hosts have between us behind the scenes. Sorry, guys. It just has to be that way.
Yeah. CJ's our facts man. I mean...
Yeah, he knew it was a book before I did.
Yeah.
No, I think it's fun that we're talking a lot about mothers, and it's technically Mother's Day now. So.
Oh, God, wow, nice. That was not done on purpose by us. That just, it's one of those magical...
We hate mothers.
It was one of those magical... The planets aligned for us to be talking about serial killers who hate their mothers on Mother's Day. It just, it is a thing.
We're going to put a timestamp on an episode.
The future's so bright, guys. We got to wear shades. They're going to want to know. It's part of the plan. Anything else from episode 3 that stands out? I mean, really, I was asking that question in relation to, I think this episode might be the first place we start to see that. I think Holden even says when he's talking to Debbie after he gets out of the shower, I have to make sure I don't let these guys rub off on me, which in itself... phrasing but he's like the way
we're still doing that.
And he says the way they look at sex, and she says and women. I think that was for me too. I get the same feeling I'm getting about him. Even before I had finished the season, I was starting to get the feeling of like, she's a little too into this, she's a little too psychological, and she's definitely got more going on behind the eyes than we're seeing or hearing in the dialogue and the actions. I think the sex distracts us from how she could be an Ed Kemper in the making too, maybe. Like, if he keeps missing that they're looking at women in a crazy way and not just sex, like, that was a very much a teaching, like, hey, fuck you, dude, how did you miss that? And I'm a little bothered by the fact that you didn't see that,
I mean, she is a sociology major, and of course, if you go into the social sciences, then you're going to be a serial killer. That's basically the prerequisite of being a murderer.
As being a soc major. And now, is that a psych major, soc major rivalry I hear coming to the surface here? Is that like a long-standing thing in those communities?
No, I mean, I love the mind, and she loves people.
That's very funny.
That's great.
Okay. All right, well, all right. I'm trying to think if there's anything major that we're leaving out, but I think those are the kind of standout arcs for this episode. And also Tench coming around, too, to the idea that they're good at this, and if bringing Carr in is going to help them find a way to turn this into a road to publishing a book or something, he's kind of on board all of a sudden. So it's nice to see that eventually everybody's kind of excited by the idea of maybe making money.
But the money.
Yeah, and he's definitely keeping everything at arm's length. He's like, Kemper thinks you are his friend. Very, very quick to put it that way. I wonder how that's going to continue to evolve as the episodes go on. So make sure you join us again for Case File 004 coming soon to a Hollow Nine RSS feed near you. Before we wrap up this week's discussion, let's go around the table and talk about what we've all got going on. Mr. T.W. Brown, what would you like to pimp your shit?
Well, Dead Snapshot Estacada's out, and with summer coming, I'm sort of... pulling back from the writing scene. I've got a lot of stuff in production as some of my multiple alter egos in audiobooks. And also, this is the time of year where my dogs sort of take front and center as I take my newfies. Working on draft cart work with one of them, working on water rescue training with both of them, and I have two new beehives that are starting to build up. So I'm working my first year as a beekeeper. So it's becoming summer.
Dude, I want some honey.
Thinning you a jar.
I want some honey. That's going to be awesome. CJ, how are things over at your camp? What's going on at Saloon 7? Talk to us.
Well, we got Grit and Grace TV coming out every Thursday night on Facebook at gritandgracetv.com. You can also catch the show Monday nights on Mile High Radio. And, we got Ron Real on Saturdays and Barracks Lawyers on Sundays.
What time is Grit and Grace on Facebook Thursdays, CJ?
That is at 10 o'clock Eastern. So it'd be what,
1 a.m. You go the other way. You get the easier route over there on the West Coast. I'm always like, oh, wait, no, 3 hours back. Nice. You lucky motherfuckers. Yeah, all right. Girl. That's cool. Everyone check that out. I tend to gate crash the chat and throw some crazy things in there on Grit and Grace every once in a while. And Mr. Zane, tell us a little bit about where people can find you, what you've got going on, what you want the folks of Internetica to know about. Pimp your shit.
Okay, sure. Not a problem at all. I'm an antisocial millennial who yabbers about nothing and everything all at the same time. And you can check that out at Yabbering with Zane, which is a weekly college radio show. And, it's produced right here at my university, so the production value is sky high. And you can check that out at bit.do/w... I'm terrible with letters. I never passed the kindergarten. It's bit.do/YWZ. Again, that's bit.do/YWZ. Got it.
And we'll go ahead and we'll link that in the show notes too for all the folks out there who are bad at listening too. You know what I mean?
Thank you. I'm bad at talking, they're bad at listening. It's a great relationship. You can also check out my Facebook page at Yabbering with Zane. And so you don't have to listen, to all my horrendous speech announcements. It's like, hello, hi, and blah 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 blah. So you don't have to listen to that. You can listen to it in text form on Facebook at Yabbering with Zane. And I'm also in the process of writing 3 audio dramas to be announced soon at a garbage can near you.
Nice. Yeah, I actually had the pleasure of getting to be a part of an episode of Yabbering with Zane, and he actually isn't lying. It may have sounded like he was joking, but his production values are sky high. So definitely check that out. Throw some port his way, and he'll be joining the cavalcade of characters on Tangent City coming back soon. We are still like madly in the process of writing and producing the last 4 hours, so we will keep you posted. I'm sure all these guys will know a little bit more about when that's coming out before everybody else. We'll probably have a little party or something. Anyway, that's then, this is now, so we're saying see you at the next meeting.
You've been listening to the Hollow Nine Network, bringing you the very best in fan-made media. That's the word hollow, the number 9, INE. Now broadcasting from our new home on the web, Hollow9.com, where you can find info on all of our awesome programming as well as the team behind the shows. Leave us your feedback, join in the conversation, and be a part of the action. Find the Hollow9 Network on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat. Rate and review us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or wherever you find your podcasts. Email us at info@hollow9.com or at hollow9podcast@gmail.com. Join in the fun. Hollow9.